Hello there, you're listening to the Watson's Daily Podcast with me, Peter Watson, on Thursday the 11th of April. Today I am joined by Saya Depp, who is a Watson's Daily subscriber. Hey there, Saya, how are you doing today?
Hi Peter, I'm doing very well, thank you, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you, all good. So which story did you pick out from today's Watson's Daily?
So the article that I chose is from the Financial Times. Currently, the complexity of artificial intelligence is creating real problems for traditional evaluation methods, which are used to gauge the accuracy and the safety of AI tools. The traditional tools are too easy to manipulate and much too narrow for the complexity of the latest AI models. And this is now posing a real challenge to businesses and public bodies over how best to work with technology that evolves so very quickly. You highlighted in Watson's Daily that the companies who develop these models are so well funded that any effort underfunded in comparison. And I think can create an imbalance in the AI ecosystem. So whilst there's an emphasis on developing cutting edge models, you know, you spoke about the AI race heating up and new AI models being released. These new versions need critical evaluation to make sure that they're reliable and effective in the real world. I think that's one of the reasons why last week the US and the UK signed a bilateral agreement on AI, which is going to hopefully minimise rapid and unexpected advances in AI. And I think that certain companies want to and are really willing to and are curious about using AI, but they need to be able to trust it. And ultimately, it's the responsibility of companies to ensure that the products they release are reliable and can be trusted by users. So I think that a failure to implement these suitable evaluation methods could actually be quite detrimental and could undermine the credibility of AI advancements and maybe even hinder their deployment in different industries and different sectors. I mean, what do you think about this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously AI is developing incredibly quickly. And as always, these kinds of things tend to develop more quickly than the regulators are able to, you know, to do. And and the other thing as well, in this particular case, we're not really talking so much about regulation, but more of a case of how do you actually measure the, you know, how do you actually measure the sort of effectiveness, if you like, of AI models, gauge them against each other. And I think the problem is that you, I mean, who wants to do that? You know, I mean, everyone wants to pile in and put all the money into developing the AI models and then making money out of it. Whereas potentially sort of providing a gauging service is, you know, you sort of think, well, where do you get the profit from that? But I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that history's kind of shown that tech companies aren't really likely to slow down. One example being that it's taken 20 years to come out with legislation for cyberbullying. And I just wonder if AI is going to take the same route.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it, really? You can't really, I think with AI developing so rapidly, I really don't think that we can sit on the sidelines like we did before, you know, because as you rightly said, you know, legislation now is only just really kind of starting to move with in terms of trying to protect people on platforms. But with AI developing so quickly and the potential use of it means that something needs to be done about it more quickly. I mean, I think, I don't know, somehow, you know, somehow someone needs to do this, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, in terms of a solution, I think that if these evaluation methods were to be adopted by the AI Safety Institute, they could come up with something and have some kind of methodology to judge the criteria, because they're established and the money could be put towards new evaluation methods. Or you could also take, you know, the PTM levy approach. So whenever you buy or sell shares over 10 grand, you get charged £1, which is called the PTM levy. And that then funds the panel of takeovers and mergers. So why not have something which can actually fund itself? That could be another way it could work. But the AI race needs to slow down, or a redefined risk assessment or self-funding AI risk assessment needs to be developed. This is clearly an issue that should be addressed, because much shorter lifespan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it certainly needs oversight or something like that. And I think that the solution that you say is good. I mean, somehow it's got to be funded. But the only thing is I suppose we need AI to be able to make money so that it can pay. So at the moment it's largely free, you know, to users, but actually at some point when it does start to charge, which, you know, we heard recently that Google, for instance, is thinking of trying to charge for some of its AI powered search. Once we start getting that kind of thing, then maybe we'll be able to do it. But I think at the moment it's going to, you know, I think at the moment it will have to be governments or something, or maybe a lot of governments put something into a central pot until such time as it can do a, like a PTM levy type thing.
Yeah.
Would have thought.
I agree. Yeah.
So, okay. Well, let's go to the next subject then. I mean, is there anything you wanted to add?
No, nothing really in particular.
Okay, cool. Right, so I'm going to talk about something that I think everyone's going to think, what is he talking about? And most people will look at this story and think it's boring and move on. However, this is one of those things where it looks boring, but actually could have absolutely massive implications in the investment banking industry. So this is a story from the Financial Times, which talks about the FCA, so the financial regulator, looking at potentially reversing MiFID rules on investment research. So I'll give you a bit of background on this, because I'd say a lot of people don't know about this. So and what I'm going to say now is a very simplified version of what it actually is. But if I went into that, it would take ages and ages and we'd be here forever. So anyway, back in the olden days, before MiFID, there was everything, you know, investment banks used to get paid by their clients, by the clients actually giving them a commission rate. Mm-hmm. And what would happen is the investment bank would provide the clients, the investor, with a number with various services like sales trading, and research, and company access, so the ability to see like CEOs and things like that when they're in town, and it would be, you know, it would be an all-inclusive rate. Okay, so this would be the commission rate. Now what then happened was we had the financial crisis, and there was a lot of you know, sort of consideration about how to incentivize, the correct way to incentivize people in investment banks, and how to make sure that there were no sort of dodgy dealings going on and people accepting things when they shouldn't in order to, I don't know, give more money to investment banks or whatever. So anyway, so once that happened, then there was legislation came in, MiFID, and then I mean, that created a bit of a stir, but really MiFID 2, which actually came into force, I think, in January 2018, that was the one that really changed things, because what that did is it forced something called unbundling. And so remember I said at the beginning that the investment banks would provide sales, sales trading, research and corporate access as part of, you know, all bundled together. Suddenly, investors, the client investors would have to pay, have to separate those payments and pay accordingly. But the problem was that because until then, no one really put a price on how much is an economics report versus, let's say, an industry report by a team of analysts on a particular sector.
Mm-hmm.
How do you put a price on a meeting with a CEO of a small company versus one of a large company, and how much do you charge for a research report?
Yeah.
And actually, it's the research report thing that's a particular relevance here, because the thing is, in order to provide coverage of lots of different companies in the various sectors, you have a really big equity research team. So remember, so for regular listeners of this, Ralph used to be one such analyst. He happened to be in the insurance team in terms of covering the insurance sector. So once MiFID II came in, a lot of clients suddenly had to get rid of lots of brokers because they just couldn't pay everyone. And it meant that a lot of brokers not only lost clients, but also they had to look at their cost base, because suddenly they had these huge teams and, you know, they cost a lot of money. I mean, I don't know exactly these days, but I think, you know, when I was headhunting, I would say that maybe it depends on the bank, it depends on the time, the sector, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have thought that a relatively junior research analyst probably get, you know, maybe around 100,000, maybe these days, something like that, maybe 120, something like that. But then once they get rated, you know, they start getting traction, voted for in the various surveys that they have, it can be many times that. So it's pretty big. And that's just one. And, you know, one person. And yet investment banks used to have loads of these people. So they were losing clients, and then they thought, right, okay, we're going to have to cut down on the costs here. So they would cut out, they would say, right, we are going to write research on companies that more people are interested in. And generally speaking, that means large companies, or as I say, large cap companies. So when I say large cap, I mean large market cap. Market cap is short for market capitalization, and it is one way that investment bankers talk about when they talk about the relative sizes of companies. So they'll say, this is a $20 billion market cap versus a $10 billion market cap. I believe, you know, from my time as a headhunter at an accountancy specialist firm, that actually accountants look at the size of companies differently, and they tend to look at companies in terms of the size of turnover. And I believe that is because they tend to be more cautious in the way they look at things generally, and turnover is way less volatile than market cap, because market cap, I think the way that you work it out is number of shares in circulation, I think that's what it is, multiplied by the share price.
Okay.
So as you can see, it means that the valuation of the market cap of a company can be very volatile, because it depends completely on the share price. But anyway, moving back to it, what the FCA is proposing to do now, so once that legislation came in, it meant that everyone had to price everything up. And as a result of that, then they, you know, they had fewer, they had a smaller investment bank, a smaller research team. Now, one of the consequences of that was that it meant that small and mid-cap companies in particular, who have a smaller investor audience, they suffered because there was no incentive for investment banks to cover them. So what a lot of these smaller companies did was they would approach these research specialists, small research boutiques, and say, hey, could you do a report on us? And they would say, yeah, sure, pay us 10 grand or 20 grand a year or something, and we'll write a report on you every quarter. Now, the problem with that is that although they have access to company figures and things, if the company is paying you as a research person to write research, you are not going to, or you are hardly likely to say, this company is terrible, don't buy it. Despite the fact that these companies always say we are totally independent, the fact of the matter is they're getting paid by the company that they're doing the report on. So some of these places have sprung up, and I guess that smaller SMEs have decided to, you know, want coverage have maybe used such companies. But if the FCA takes this unbundling away and allows bundling once more, then I think that the investment banks could well decide to beef up their research teams once more,
yeah,
and take advantage of the fact that, generally speaking, the quality of research is not very good for small and mid-cap companies, because there's not the competition, there's not the breadth of research available that there used to be. So this could be absolutely massive. And I think that this is interesting, because this is particularly interesting in the terms of the timing, because it seems, again, that we are seeing a number of signs which suggest that M&A activity is coming back.
Yeah.
So there are many reasons potentially for investment banks to increase their headcount. So M&A, you know, or support for M&A potentially, or maybe they won't have support just yet, but they will do soon when things really do start picking up. But then research as well, because you also need research departments and coverage of companies in order to get to win the business of, let's say, capital raisings, stock splits, you know, all sorts of things that basically you can get money from, you know, as an investment banker. So actually that's another reason for them to get more research coverage. And that means you're probably going to get more, business from these companies, because they will give you business if you cover them. So, but anyway, I know that's sort of a bit of long drawn out and a thing, but I just wanted to explain it, because it's something that I don't think is in any book. I don't think is in any article or anything I've ever seen. So I just wanted to try to hopefully make that a bit clearer for people who are listening to this. But what do you think anyway? What's your sort of impression?
I think that this policy change could be quite positive. I agree that investment banks who act first by providing this research, they're going to do really well, especially those smaller and more niche research providers. I think they're going to have the opportunity to then compete on a more equal footing with the larger. So I think that it could be quite positive in that sense. I think that it could also enhance by encouraging increased participation from asset managers that previously might have been a bit reluctant or deterred by the cost of research, or they may have had smaller departments and so could only really focus on the big stocks that people were interested in. So I think that by providing access to a wider range of research insights, investors are, they're going to be able to make more informed trading decisions. And I think that overall, that's going to contribute to a more dynamic market environment. So, yeah, I think that it could be very positive.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will. I think it, if it does go ahead, I think there'll be a big sigh of relief generally. I mean, around the city. I think that I think the small research providers, as in the small independents, will have a hard time, because what will happen is, if they, you know, they may be ditched in favour of the bigger, the bigger investment banks with loads of research, because the thing is that they will have broader coverage. And so as a client, you'd think, actually, I'd rather have access to that.
Yeah.
Because the whole idea, in a way, it was interesting, because when MiFID II came in, everyone said, oh, this is going to be great for small independent research providers. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll have their work valued, they'll get paid properly. But it sort of did happen, but not as much as everyone thought.
Yeah.
But I think going the other way, I think, you know, that actually they've been, I think investors have been starved of better quality research, particularly in the small and mid cap arena, that actually this could be really positive for them. Because, again, this is not something that not everyone knows, I know. So I'm trying to explain this here, is that if you are like a big investor, like let's take Fidelity, for instance, right? So, Fidelity is an investment management company. Now, they have their own teams of research, right? So they have their own pharmaceuticals team, tech team, bank, you know, financials team, etc. And what they tend to do, it's all slightly different depending on which company you're in, but they will draw up a list. They will basically, so the pharmaceuticals lot will, you know, do loads of research, and they use the research of pharmaceuticals researchers, let's say, in investment banks, and that all feeds into them, and they put something together, and it says, and they come up with their recommendation, their internal Fidelity recommendations, and then the fund managers, they do their own research, and then they kind of also look at their own in-house research. So anyway, in something like Fidelity, they've got loads of resource. They've got their own in-house research. On the other hand, if you are a small investor, you have no research. You have to do it all on your own, or you have to go out. And that's where the problem is that, you know, they don't have the internal resource. So they can't compete against the big guys. So this may be better, because hopefully the smaller investors will hope that they can get more broader access, and so in terms of the, you know, better quality research. So we'll obviously have to see what happens.
Yeah.
And it's not a foregone conclusion, but it will have a really big impact on investment banking, and at a very interesting point in time. And I also think as well that, you know, linking this with, say, some other stories that have been going on recently, that I think this could be, if this changes, this could be hugely positive for investment banks and investment banking in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I say that is because, so firstly, it looks, all the reasons why I say this, firstly, is M&A activity appears to be increasing. So that's good. So things are turning around, and that's where the big money is earned. The second thing is that there's no bonus cap here in the UK. So you could earn, you know, whereas in Europe, that I think it was twice your basic salary, right? So there's that. So that's no uncapped bonus. And then the third thing is that now you're having this, you know, potentially you're not being restricted on the whole, you know, you're not being restricted on the research. Suddenly that makes the UK look extremely attractive,
yeah.
I would say, versus Europe. So any kind of incentives that they're providing in, say, Paris or Frankfurt. Although, I mean, I am half joking when I say this. I've never met anyone that I've worked with who've said, I love Frankfurt to work in. They all say it's boring. I'm sorry to offend anyone. I think even Ralph says it's boring, as a place to work. But but if you've put those three things together, so loads of earning power, a big uplift in banks wanting research analysts, and the potential for a lot more M&A equals huge earning potential.
Yeah.
So that's what I would have thought would happen. But yeah, I know I've ranted for a while, but do you have any thoughts or anything on that?
I mean, no, I agree with what you say. And I think that this policy change, yeah, it could be really, really positive.
So we'll see, won't we? But I actually would say again to listeners that I did have a quick chat about this very topic yesterday with Legal Liz, who has been on the podcast, and I think that we are going to be doing a podcast that covers this, and it will be very interesting to hear Legal Liz's take on this, having been on this kind of again on the inside, as it were. I think we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for your time, Sire.
For
your insight, no problem. And also thank you very much for listeners for listening. Have a great day, whatever you're up to, and we'll be back again soon. Many thanks. Bye.